This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 27 for Thursday, October 1st, 2009, Lost Planet. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store. Welcome to another edition of Out of Line After Hours. Boy, what a week it's been. All kinds of news. We got all kinds of people in here to talk about it. But of course, starting with Mr. Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo. Peter.
John.
Hello, sir.
Great to be here. How about them Lions?
Oh, the Lions chalked one up. Got the monkey off their back,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Let's hope they did.
Yeah.
And joining us, too, David Welch from Business Week. David, how you doing?
Good. Good to be here, John.
And we've got our special guest today, Eric Merkel from Autoconomy. Great having you here, Eric.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I've known you as an analyst at other places. Tell us about Autoconomy. What do you do?
Well, at Autoconomy, it's my website. It's something that I've launched, and it's a letter that I put out, publish every week. I talk about the industry, talk about many of the economic variables that are impacting the industry right now. There's been quite a few over the last 18 to 24 months, and we also, of course, get into cars. And it's really Autoconomy. It's where automotive and the economy merge. So we talk about the economy, and then also about the cars and future trends and things that are happening out there in the industry.
So how do people find out about your newsletter? How can they subscribe?
Well, you can just go to autoconomy.com.
Okay.
So
you charge for this? What do you charge?
Yes, there is a charge for it. It's a pretty nominal amount. It's $139 a year, and then there's also a monthly chargeable fee where you can do it monthly at $18.95 a month.
Okay.
So, and I also have a blog out there, so I like to put some vehicles out there and give my overall general impression and opinion of some of the new models and things like that that are coming out. So,
well, let's get some of your take on what's gone on this week. There's so much to talk about, but sales just came out today. We just learned about what sales were like in September. What's your initial reaction to what you've heard or seen so far?
Well, it's I thought that we could likely keep our chin just above 9 million units. So it's not surprising. It doesn't shock me. I knew that there would be a skip in September because we had such strong activity in the month of August, as you know, from Cash for Clunkers. And when I look at the month of, really the month of August and compare it to September, and I go back to another program, which was Keep America Rolling, where we had 0% financing.
In 2001, after the 9/11 attacks.
Exactly. Back in the sales are behaving much the same. It's not really that much different than what we saw with Keep America Rolling. Now, a lot of folks will say, well, Erica, October of 2001, we hit almost 21 million units SAR, and that's true. It was only 14.1 here in August. However, if you look at it on a sequential basis, we were coming off a much lower base going into Cash for Clunkers than we were at the time when we went into Keep America Rolling. So the sequential increase is pretty comparable to what we saw actually back in 2001.
David Welch, what do you make of these sales numbers that come in? Are you surprised, or are you surprised on the upside or the downside, or what?
No, we'd seen some forecasts in the past week or two that we'd be around or a little above 9 million units. We knew there was going to be a payback for Cash for Clunkers. And in fact, I was interviewing Fritz Henderson a week or two ago, and he said, there's going to be a payback. It'll be pretty steep, but we think it'll be short-lived. We'll see if the second part of his prediction is true. I mean, it depends how much was pulled ahead. But, yeah, it was pretty much expected because, like Eric said, 14 million units. And when we've been seeing 9 to 10 million SARs every month, you're going to get that sort of payback because the economy is not really recovering yet. I mean, there's been some bottoming out maybe, but there hasn't been a bounce yet. So I don't think there's a lot of natural demand coming out of the economy.
I don't know, Peter, when I look at these numbers, I don't think this is that bad of a drop-off.
I don't really think it is either. There was going to be a hangover and lots of hand-wringing, but, let's move on. Let's see what October, November bring.
Well, the thing I keep saying is forget comparing to a year ago. A year ago was such a different market than what's going on today. I keep saying let's look at the last 3 to 4 months moving. So let's not look at September 2008. Let's look at June, July, August, September of this year and see what's happening. And it, before Cash for Clunkers, sales were sort of hovering at around 850,000 units a month. Mm-hmm. So last month, we dropped down to 750,000 a month. I don't think that that's a very bad drop-off. And if what they're also telling us, that sales picked up in the second half of September, and October is going to look better because now there's inventory back in. If October comes in even halfway decent, then I'm going to say Cash for Clunkers was a resounding success, and it did not really hurt the market that much by pulling all these people forward.
I agree with you. You know, people have criticized it, and, you know, there were some execution problems with it as it relates to dealers and, you know, the government.
But that was a dealer problem. That really didn't affect consumers that much.
But when you start taking a look at it in terms of its impact on the overall economy, and you start looking at $3 billion, and to the guy on the street, $3 billion seems like a lot of money. It does to me too, David. So, but $3 billion seems like a lot of money. But when you look at it relative to everything else that the government has put in to stimulate this economy, I think you got a tremendous bang for your buck out of that $3 billion because it went around the state governments, you know, the coffers because the states are all in trouble. It went around the banks and it went directly to the consumer. And guess what? The consumer had to take action. And I mean, in order to derive the benefit, you had to go out and purchase a new car. So I think, in my opinion, I think from a macroeconomic perspective, I think it was a very successful shot in the arm to our economy.
But we were going to see some kind of uptick in the fall because we're in the new model year and the new selling season anyway. So there was going to be some sort of uptick just coming from that. So, you know, how much, I mean, it's really tough to grade because there are, you know, like any good economist, you know, you've got mm-hmm. things on one hand and on the other. So, you know, when you get the new model year coming out, dealers are clearing out the old stuff. So there's some enthusiasm for new models, discounting already there for the old stuff. You know, so you're going to see a rise anyway. So how much of, you know, how much of this sort of little bit of a bump we're seeing, you know, GM saying it's going to be, what, 10.3 or 10.5 for the year when they were saying it was.
Ford saying 11.
When they were saying it was going to be much more before. Cash for Clunkers did something. I just don't think it lived up to the hype. And, I don't think it was that big
of a
boom, really.
I think it did. Here's what I'll add.
I'm saying we pulled some sales ahead, and you're saying the pull ahead wasn't that big because you don't think the drop-off was that big. But I think we were already. I agree with Edmonds on this. I think some of the increase, and it's a small one that we're seeing, is because we are in the selling season. You're already seeing, you know, you're seeing some deals on the old stuff, and you're seeing some new stuff that is generating a bit of enthusiasm.
But here's the difference this time, I think, is that whenever you go into the fall season with the new models, the dealers are in a mad scramble to dump the prior model year's
right.
cars.
Mm-hmm.
Them cars is gone. I mean, there is like no inventory.
Them cars that qualified for the clunkers, the other stuff, there's inventory and
still pretty low. I mean, you're talking at an industry that's what, around 30 days total inventory? And what I'm getting at is now going into the 2010s, we're seeing the Detroit automakers and others getting much better pricing for their cars. And so I think dealers are going to make a lot more money in this fourth quarter.
See, my own personal opinion is as we get in the Cash for Clunkers, I mean, there's no doubt it cleared out a lot of inventory. In fact, it was reported by Ward's that inventory dropped to levels that we hadn't seen since 1983. So that really put the automakers behind the eight ball, so to speak. They're going in and they're having to now produce to replenish those inventories. And from an economic perspective, that then cascades through the entire industry, down to suppliers, to many of the raw material makers, plastics, copper, steel.
Well, we had Tim Lulliet in here last mm-hmm. week, and that was the point he was making. Even if car sales are exactly the same next year as this year, suppliers are going to do a lot better.
Because they've already cut out a lot.
Because so many sales this year in the first half of the year all came out of inventory. And now the automakers have to build to fill orders.
Precisely.
So suppliers are back to supplying again, which they didn't do in the first half.
All these companies have cut to live in this new, you know, 10 million market reality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, supposedly Chrysler can make money at 10 million units, although the market share is lower than.
So the way Chrysler's going, I don't think that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, remember,
their numbers look horrific for the month.
I think didn't their turnaround plan call for 10% market share?
Yes, and
they're below it now.
It's blowing.
And for the month, they were at 8.3% market share.
Yeah, and
calendar year to date, I think it's.
And calendar year to date, what did we say, 9%?
9%. Yeah. And there's nothing to hold that up. I think that market share is going to continue to drop and go lower, unfortunately.
They don't have the product coming.
And Sergio Marchionne stepping out in Frankfurt saying didn't really realize how bad it was. It's just like, huh? Everybody else did, and he's just getting to that point.
I think the Ram truck is a great product, but I mean, we were talking a little bit before the show, John, and the fact that I think the Wrangler is their third best-selling vehicle, that to me is kind of scary because there's a lot of other Chrysler vehicles, the Sebring and the Avenger and, the Compass and the Patriot. And
they're talking about freshening things?
And they're talking about freshening, and I know from...
For the short term? Boy, that's ugly.
Exactly. From my years of, forecasting, I know the mid-cycle facelifts, I mean, they really don't.
Well, it depends. It depends. Look at Ford's mid-cycle facelift on the Fusion. It's been brilliant for it.
Ford's mid-cycle facelifts are probably the most pronounced of any automaker right now.
Okay, well, but if Chrysler can pull off a good facelift or good freshening, it'll help.
With the PT Cruiser. Because, I mean, that's been 10 years.
The car that won't die. I mean, they keep saying we're going to stop producing this, and it keeps selling. So they go, oh, okay, we'll build some more.
Exactly.
With a car that they've done nothing to for, what, the last 6 years?
Exactly. They've got two problems with their product line. Not only is it stale and does it need a lot of major overhaul, but the stuff that's sitting there, they had nothing recommended by Consumer Reports. These vehicles, the product line is just not good. And it's always difficult to prove that, but they aren't selling, they aren't recommended by Consumer Reports, they don't do well in quality surveys.
Market share is falling.
Yeah, consumers do this research, not even about the market share stuff, but just reading Consumer Reports, JD Power surveys and initial quality and stuff like that. That stuff does influence someone's buying decision, and they don't do well under any of those metrics, and it's going to be really tough for them to get some traction.
There is one car I think they could surprise with, and I think that would be the replacement, the full changeover to the new Charger. I think they could surprise with that. However, it's going to take more than one vehicle.
And the 300. I mean,
and the 300,
the 300,
which
300 really
looks
good.
Pretty good. Yeah. The new Grand Cherokee, I think, looks terrific.
But again, we're all looking at our watches. When is this stuff going to hit, and how long will it take for those the new stuff to gain momentum?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they got a tall order there.
I think that there's a few cars that could, a couple cars that might surprise, but how do you offset everything else that's, heading into the dirt? I mean, there's really Chrysler, when you look at some of their product launches, when they came out the 300C and the Charger earlier in the decade, that was just a beautiful thing. And then, they followed up with the Sebring and the Avenger, which were not beautiful things. Mm. And that's really where they needed to have a hit. They needed a hit in that midsize sedan.
Well, they need a mainstream hit. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Or a good crossover. And the Journey, that really
could have been the car that could have been.
Yes.
It's got one another suck-ass interior like they've been putting out.
Can we say that?
Well, we just did.
Yeah,
Yeah.
It's the internet.
It's the internet.
But,
so.
I mean, I love the packaging on the Journey. I think it's a really well-sized, international-sized vehicle.
Yes.
But the interior is terrible. And I know Ralph Gill, who runs Chrysler Design, says, just will you wait till we put the real one in
that
there.
That sounds like GM, though. Just wait right around the corner. Going to get real good real soon.
Right. But I thought...
The cavalry's coming over the hill with the next model year.
The exterior on the Journey, I thought, was just kind of, it's there.
Yeah, it's not striking either.
It's not striking, but it's...
The overall package was really good.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the execution. Chrysler, it's always about the final execution.
You look at Chrysler's line, you got stuff like the Journey that's just not exciting, and then you have stuff like Caliber that's just overwrought. They don't have anything that's, I'm not a huge fan of the new Taurus, but I think it has a nice stance. It's very tastefully done. I mean, they don't have a mainstream model that isn't really boldly styled, that it gets stale after a couple of years or it turns a lot of people off. And then they have, they have stuff that's either, really aggressive or really dull, and there's nothing that's just sort of well done in there and that's going to get
high volume. Well, again, I keep coming back to the legacy costs, and when you have $1,500 of retirement health care baked into your car before you even start job one, you got to do everything else on the cheap to try to make it up somehow. Mm-hmm. And I'm just hoping all that is beyond us now, behind us. As far as the Detroit 3 automakers go, to me, there's no more excuses. If they come out with crap anymore, shoot them.
Well, I think, you know, if we look at one of the Detroit 3 automakers, it's got to be Ford. I mean, Ford is really turning it around. I mean, I've just seen product after product, and, you know, the cycle cadence is full.
Their product cadence in the next 30 months is staggering.
Going to be impressive.
Has anyone driven the new Fiesta?
Yeah, I've driven it.
Isn't that, I mean, I
terrific little car.
To like a rabbit in the bush. I mean, it just.
In fact, I drove it a year ago, and I said, man, I would actually take this over a Honda Fit.
Yes.
And then I thought, wow, I'm saying I'd take a Ford over a Fit? Wow. And that's how good the car is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to that launch. I mean, when it comes out next year, I think that...
Well, I'm waiting, and I know Ford wants to get me in the U.S. spec version, because that's my fear. In Europe, cars are more expensive than they are here.
You can get price on
put a nicer interior in, better materials.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to cheapen it down here? They tell me no, but I want to see the thing before I believe what they're telling me.
Mm-hmm.
They've trained me in that way.
I think you'll be pleased, I mean, with the U.S. spec version. I do.
Good. So good to hear. Hey, what do you make of the Saturn deal, or the lack of a Saturn deal?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think Roger and Carlos had a deal. They had an understanding. And the board thing, someone at the board said, run this by us again. You're going to give Roger Penske stuff to sell against our stuff in the U.S. against Nissan? How does that work exactly? And, you know, it must have been like a board revolt, mm-hmm. best I can tell.
I think you're right, Peter, because to me it's highly unusual that this broke down literally at the last minute. The day before, we were all told or led to believe that the signing was
coming. I reported this in my story yesterday. Roger Penske and Jill Ajak, who's the general manager of Saturn, they plan to kick off, a 9-city roadshow starting next week. They were going to start in San Francisco and I think go to Vegas and Dallas, or maybe L.A. and Dallas, and start telling all the retailers about it and what was going to happen. And
it was a done deal.
Yeah. They thought they had something. And, I mean, all the Saturn dealers, including dealers I've talked to who were in the know, were just stunned by this.
Yeah. I feel sorry for them. I truly do.
I do.
I think it's a very sad development.
Conversely, I think GM dodged a bullet.
How so?
Here. Well, look, in early August when GM had the event up in Milford and in Warren to show the product, I asked Fritz Henderson, what are you doing here? You're handing some competitor, whoever Roger gets product from, this terrific dealer network to compete against you. And he just said, look, this wasn't about a business strategy. It was about basically doing right by the Saturn dealers. And, we're not going to make it easy for them to compete. Well, when you're GM and you're fighting for every sale and you're trying to rebuild your brands and you're offering 60-day guarantees to get people, money-back guarantees to get people into cars, handing some competitor, I don't care whether, Roger was going to sell Indian cars or Chinese cars or Nissans or Renaults or what, you're taking 350 hand-picked dealers of GMs, really good retailers.
Mm-hmm.
You're lining them up with arguably the best retailer in the world, Roger Penske. And then you're going to take some Renault-Nissan product, which is generally pretty good, and then you're going to fight that in the market where you need to turn around the most. I think GM was I was always mystified by this thing because GM was in bankruptcy because they couldn't help themselves, and they still feel that somehow they had to help their dealers and do. I mean, look, it's a great gesture and it's great for dealer relations, but when you're coming out of bankruptcy, save thyself. And I just thought this was setting up a competitor to have a great retail network to kick their butt here in the U.S.
But at the end of the day, a bunch of people are out of work. A bunch of really good dealers are going to have to scramble, and some of them aren't going to be able to scramble.
Yeah.
And they're just going to close.
And that's
close.
The sad part is because we all know that the Saturn dealers were just phenomenal.
Cream of the crop.
For the most part.
For the most part. One local where it ain't so good.
But, when you start comparing them to other dealership networks in the country, I mean, they rank right up there at the top, in some cases right behind Lexus. So that's pretty good company.
Well, look, they kind of blazed the way for Lexus in cases.
Yes.
But, again, Tim Lulliet, who used to work for Roger, who was here last week, I thought made a really good point. He said, look, this is a dealer retail play for Roger Penske and the Penske Automotive Group. This isn't a car company kind of move.
No, because he wasn't going to be making any.
He wasn't going to be, right. And so here's the Penske Automotive Group, second only to AutoNation in terms of the big publicly held networks, that's able to pick up 350-plus of the best points with the best management. I mean, that's what it was all about. And I'm hoping for the dealer's sake that that still applies and that, you know, Roger was hoping he got, you know, one-stop shopping with GM, got a package deal. But I'm hoping companies like Penske Automotive Group, AutoNation, Sonic, and the rest of them go in and start cherry-picking these dealers. And
Kia's already talking to them.
Are they really?
Yeah. Some of the dealers have been approached by
Kia. That would be brilliant for Kia to make.
It would.
It'd be brilliant for anyone to go approach these guys and say, look, I mean, the great thing about Saturn is that, you know, for the most part, I mean, Saturn's only 19, 20 years old. Most of these points are relatively new, so they're in the good traffic zones within the markets.
Where you want to be.
Yeah, and, you know, they're not old, decrepit stores because just a couple of years ago, Saturn had a big... you know, one of those big image campaigns to get all the dealers very consistent and spruced up. And whether you like the theme or not doesn't really matter. They're new points, and they can be re-signed and rebadged and everything else to sell something that somebody else has. These are good retailers with good points in the right locations.
What if Hyundai decided to sell their new top luxury sedan?
The Equus.
In these Saturn dealers.
Launch a new luxury division.
Rebrand them, launch a new luxury division. Pop those Saturn signs off and have an instant first-rate, top-notch dealer network.
When you look at a couple of the auto companies, it is Hyundai and it is Kia. And, you know, if they want to continue to expand their operation here and continue to expand their market share as they've been doing so well, you know, I think it would make a lot of sense. I mean, it would, in many ways, for them to look at that. Is that as an opportunity?
And Hyundai's got the money. They could probably round up those dealers in Las Vegas and say, here's the pitch. You're going to become Equus dealers.
You know, I just did a piece in the magazine about how tough it'll be for Tesla and Fisker to compete with the big boys at selling plug-in hybrids, electric cars, and this sort of thing. And one of the, I mean, they've got a, you know, I think cost issues and everything else, but one of the problems they have is really small dealer networks. And Tesla's got seven, and they're going to add maybe, you know, four or five more. Fisker's got 45 lined up, and they want to have 100, but that's still tiny compared. You know, what if they approach these guys?
They just don't have the vehicle.
No, they don't. But I mean, they could get a few of them at least. I mean, you know, they're going to need dealer presence if they want to do. I mean, Fisker's talking about 130,000 vehicles a year.
He's really been bordering on snake oil salesman.
That is snake oil.
Ever since the moment he first opened his mouth. Look, I respect the guy as a designer, but this has been nothing but P.T. Barnum snake oil stuff from the moment he launched this thing. I mean,
I totally agree.
Yeah. I basically said the $528 million that we gave him, we're not going to see return on it in terms of of, you know, the interest in the loan. We probably won't get the money back because I don't think they'll make it. And we're not going to see a return on that technology either because, remember, Fisker may be putting out a plug-in hybrid, but they're an integrator. They don't come up with their own lithium-ion battery chemistry or battery technology or power electronics and that sort of thing. They work with the suppliers to develop it, but they're not the guys to do it.
They're just going to...
I mean,
somebody called them a kit car company, and I kind of like that.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
Right now there's so much government money that's going just everywhere. I mean, green is kind
of... But we talked about
it's
this last week.
Here's
a company that has never built a car.
I know.
It's a year away from building a car. The cars are going to be $90,000. And by the way, they're going to get built in Finland, and yet these guys get over $500 million.
Well, the thing of it is I'm not disagreeing or I'm not arguing. I'm just saying that because it's such a political hot topic right now,
this is one of these flowing all over the place.
You know,
after giving $50 billion to General Motors, and what's the tally for the banks? What did that get up
to? After throwing out
massive amounts of money like that, you know, people in government are like, yeah, $528 million, you know, that's
a rounding error.
Yeah. So, sure, we can do that project, not a problem at all. And you're not gonna, I just don't see how we
I wish they would have given me that money because I would have taken it and built America's version of the Nordschleife in northern Michigan, the longest natural terrain road course in the United States with digital wiring and everything. It would have been great. Just have to come up with a name for it.
All you have to do is get a grant writer.
Well,
and you put Al Gore on your board.
You want to do what?
Hey, but speaking of all these dollars, I wonder if another thing that torpedoed the Penske-Saturn deal at the last minute with Renault is the way the dollar is sinking. And, you know, if you talked with Renault, let's say, 3, 4, 5 months ago about importing Samsung cars from Korea, and all of a sudden the dollar's, boom, taking a nosedive, I wouldn't be surprised if the board's looking at the deal and going, how are we going to make any money on this?
Yeah, I think that could have had some, but, you know, when you start taking a look at this thing and you start looking at when GM was going to transition out of Saturn and when the Renault and the SsangYong vehicles were going to start replacing them, you're still looking, you know, a couple years out, year and a half, 2 years.
Just saying by then maybe the dollar will have rebounded. I mean,
you know, it's
you don't plan it on currency.
Yeah, it's really hard to.
Well, but the thing is, you look at, you know, the foreign automakers are starting to. I mean, they're building more plants here because
they're in a
panic. Because they think the dollar will be weak forever, but because they don't want to manage a business with this fluctuation.
It's terrible trying to manage your business like that. But I think the real issue, though, John, back to Peter's point, is just they didn't want to make cars for Saturn that were going to compete with Nissan here in the United States. So.
Well, though, just sticking on this dollar exchange rate thing a minute, yesterday the president of Honda came out and said, whoa, Nelly, at 90 to the dollar, we're on very thin ice exporting cars to America. And if it goes much below that, they may not be able to make any money on this.
I mean, for Toyota, I believe every fluctuation of 1 yen to the dollar is $350 or $400 million to the bottom line, I think.
I don't know if it's that high, but you're right. It's significant.
Really, yeah,
it's significant.
Of money.
And you're talking 1 yen difference.
Yeah. Well, I remember one quarter, Toyota made $4 billion just on the exchange.
Right.
And that happened quarter after quarter after quarter.
Yeah, one time BMW and Mercedes were making a tremendous amount of money just on the exchange rate. And
when you've seen automakers take a hit in their earnings on some of the currency arbitrage that they do to try to...
Sure.
Or currency hedging that they try to do to manage that. And that's it's a level of complexity that I don't think any of these companies really want in their business if they can afford it. I mean, I think what they all want to do is build where they sell, and then they use their overseas plants. If the market's hot, they'll export it over here where they can.
And, yeah, and that was exactly my point, David. I've been on some of these talk shows on this circuit and things like that, and I was on with another individual, use names, I can't remember his name actually, but they were talking, it was all about, well, just make the cars in China. It's like, well, China's halfway around the world. I mean, logistically and the shipping and transportation costs and the exchange rate fluctuate, it's very difficult. I mean, if you look at Toyota's model, they build and produce in the markets in which they sell. And I still think
they're only building about half of their U.S. sales.
There's no question.
They overbuilt. Yeah. How about the... Let's talk about the Tokyo Auto Show.
Yeah, there's one that we got to
talk about. Payback.
Yeah, because what we learned is that virtually all the major non-Japanese car companies are dropping out of the Tokyo Auto Show. And I think it's easy to see why. Not one foreign car company has a plant in Japan. Talk about build where you sell them. Well, Japan's never let anybody in, really. Also, import car sales in Japan are under 5%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're going to go to all this expense and all this trouble to bring all your people and cars over to market it to what? People who can't buy your cars?
Why
do it? And I think the Tokyo show, it's history, you know. Put a fork in it. This thing is done.
Plus,
it'll never recover.
It's an every other year show because, for what we are interested in. Isn't it commercial trucks on the year or commercial vehicles on the year that it's not?
Yeah, but it's been totally eclipsed by Shanghai now.
That's what I was going to say.
No question.
If you really want to reach the Asian market with buzz and with new cars, it is the Shanghai show.
Sure, because China says, come on in, you can build cars here, come on in, you can sell cars here.
Well,
the Koreans pay attention.
Seize them in a few years.
Exactly.
But nationalize them.
The Shanghai Auto Show, I think, is just, it's eclipsed Tokyo.
Yeah, and so, boy, Tokyo. They're reeling.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't believe this is deliberate payback.
No.
But it's just when dollars are squeezed, you go, why are we knocking our brains out to go to the Tokyo show?
Porsche and Nissan, who do a lot of business in the U.S., pulling back on the Detroit Auto Show.
Well, now Porsche's coming back.
Yeah. Oh, are they really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I had not heard.
Because they discovered they weren't getting the buzz from the LA.
Which we talked about is going to happen.
Isn't that something? But if we switch over to the Detroit show here, my understanding is that we'll be full this year at the Detroit show.
Yeah, it will be
full.
We've
got really good
news. Does that mean Nissan's coming back?
Yes.
Yes, they're all coming in, including Porsche, because they just weren't getting they didn't have the media exposure.
Yeah, they didn't have the media because not all the media go to L.A.
I talked to one of Nissan's PR guys about it, and he said it wasn't a cost move. They just thought it was too difficult for them to get the message out during the show with all the noise and all the product intros, but must be that didn't work for him.
Yeah. Well, look, the Detroit show is the center of the universe for the media as far as auto shows in North America go.
Well, it's because it's the only one that's a big show every year. In Europe, it's either Frankfurt or Paris every other year. The Tokyo show is basically in every other year. Nobody really cares about the Tokyo because, like you said, it's a Japanese-centric show. It's for that market. We don't sell anything. Our car companies don't sell anything over there.
We don't go to the Bologna auto show either. Or the...
I'd like to.
Yeah, it's a good play.
I go to the Monaco auto show.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, well, dream on. Hey, but also Toyota in the news this week for this floor mat problem, and you wrote about that in your column.
I've been crucified, flamed, dismembered, and everything from irate readers based in California for my insensitivity to the...
And your whole thing was personal responsibility. Don't blame Toyota if you didn't pay attention to your floor mat and it's wadded up under the gas pedal.
Well, you see the amount of attention people pay to a number of things, and remember that floor mat that you had? It's right under your pedals there. People just, they're quick to blame someone. It's not my fault. Someone's going to pay. And, it was a tragic situation. An off-duty policeman and a family were killed. But, I still think it's a personal responsibility. When you're behind the wheel, it's you. There's nobody else, working the pedals and steering the wheel and working the shift. You have to make solid judgments. And if there's a problem, why were they on calling 911? Mm-hmm. They should be, focusing on what can we do right now to stop this vehicle? Put it in neutral? Well, you said it, John. Put it in neutral.
Well, the first thing I said is push on the brakes. I don't care how fast the engine is revving. I don't care how fast the car is traveling.
If you break
the brakes, whatever, will always bring the car to a stop. In fact, I've done this before. You go 70 miles an hour down the freeway, floor the car, keep your foot on the gas, and then just mash the brakes. The car will come to a stop. Mm-hmm. So now I understand, maybe the floor mat's wadded up under the brake pedal, too. Okay, to your point, put it in neutral. Now, if you're driving a Prius, because the Prius was involved in the recall, although I don't think this involved a Prius at all, if you guys have driven the thing, it's got that funky little shifter. Oh, I could see where people go, how the hell do you put this thing in neutral?
Well, the Prius, there was another problem with the Prius that wasn't floor mats, that was something with the drivetrain. Just randomly sort of taking off. That's a whole nother thing.
But how much of this does, look, Toyota still has a great image, great reputation for quality.
Although they've been taken as a series of...
Well, they're doing a lot of television advertising, talking about how long-lived their cars are, how long they last.
They've got a new print campaign. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's actually quite clever in national newspapers. It's this big on the bottom of...
A banner at the bottom of the page?
Yeah, it's a little bigger than a banner.
But the issue here is, you had that engine sludge problem that got them a lot of bad press. You had a couple of big recalls with Tundra and Sequoia, and now you've got, this issue. Look, it's a format issue. It's not that big a deal.
You know what? Go ahead. That thought, because I got another point.
They're still up at the top in the quality surveys. But, in some of the recent surveys, they've either been matched or beaten by some of the Ford, GM, and Hyundai brands. Mm-hmm. And, that sort of dulls the edge that they have. And they're going to have to, I think they're just going to have to either find a way to sharpen that again, or better yet, they're going to have to get some passion in their cars with design and performance, because everybody's getting good quality and everyone has big recalls.
Precisely.
And they're going to be sort of, I don't think this is going to make people think the way they do with the domestic automakers in the 70s and 80s that Toyota makes bad cars. But I think it will, people start looking at Toyota and say, they've got their problems too. the cars aren't perfect. You know, you look at the quality surveys, a Buick did just as well, a Hyundai did better, on and on. And they just don't have the big edge as the quality company anymore.
Well, and I wrote about it this week, their biggest nightmare in this market is Hyundai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Whose quality has been rocketing up the charts.
And I will tell you, the other thing is Hyundai, when you look at the design of their vehicles, not only do they have the quality, but they have the design as well.
Well, they're getting there.
I think they are. You know, if you
I said they're getting there. They haven't. They're not quite there.
Well, I think if you look at you know, if you've anyone seen anything on, you know, the new Sonata that's coming out, I think that's a brilliantly designed vehicle. Certainly much better than the Camry. I've always said that Toyota
it looks a lot like ES350.
Joel Piotrkowski did a fabulous job. He has now gone to Mercedes.
Correct.
Yeah. I spent money on design. I've been out to the studio. For Kia too, and you know they've got Peter Schreier from Audi over there.
Right.
You know, we talked about this a little bit last week. You know, they're not there with design, but they're starting to.
Oh, they're getting there.
Certain models are absolutely there, and it's the Joel Piotrkowski and the Peter Schreier models that I think are there. But you know, going back to the floor mat thing, I guarantee you, Toyota's not the only car company having a problem like this.
This issue with press cars that I've had with a floor mat.
I've had the floor mat thing happen to me before where it got jammed under the gas pedal. And what did I do? I pushed on the brakes.
I drive a six-speed. I just hit the clutch. You know, I mean, you figure it out. Although I was in a press car once, and it wasn't the floor mat, but it is very jarring. I was at the parking garage for our building, and I went to swipe the card so I could get out of there, and I dropped the card down. And so I'm leaning down to get it, and I've got my foot on the brake, but as I'm doing it, my foot sort of shifted over, and I'm hitting the accelerator. And all of a sudden, my engine's revving like crazy, and the car lurches forward a couple of inches, and I stomp the brake really hard, and I'm trying to figure out, why is the engine going? I'm like, oh, my foot's on the gas.
Yeah, right.
But it's, I mean, you can see why you can have an accident like this, because all of a sudden your engine's going, and you really haven't figured out why, because it's either, you know.
Look, Audi found that out. You know, unintended acceleration was driver error, pure and simple.
Absolutely.
60 Minutes tried to concoct this BS story about how the transmission.
And they took Audi from 77,000 annual sales to 19,000.
Right.
In less than 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Was the issue that the car idled very high?
No, I'll tell you exactly what the problem was.
I thought it was because when they did their pedals.
Too close.
Well, no, with automatics. In Europe, they have, you know, three pedals. They didn't redesign it for automatic use. They just left the pedals away. That was my theory.
I'll tell you exactly what was happening. This was in the mid-80s. This was around 87, something like that.
It was the Audi 5000, right?
Audi 5000. Yeah. They were making tremendous conquest amongst Buick and Oldsmobile owners. And if you look at the pedal where the Buick and the Olds were, the Audi was a little bit farther over. So when people would go naturally to where they thought the brake pedal was, they're hitting the gas. And they're going, I know I had my foot on the brake. It obviously was the car's problem. Yeah. And Audi went into exhaustive investigations into this. And what came out of that is the shift lock interlock, or the brake pedal interlock that we have right now. Throughout the whole industry. You put your foot on the brake, and now you can put it into drive. Audi was the first to do it, and it came out of an unintended acceleration. That's when NHTSA went, this is a no-brainer. We mandate this across the board.
But didn't PX say that it was stupid American drivers or women drivers or something like that?
I don't know if it was PX who said that, but they blamed the driver, and they were right. From a technical standpoint, but from a public relations standpoint, it was dead wrong.
Exactly.
You do what Tylenol did. You know, we're going to seal these medicine bottles so nobody can put poisonous ones in there. Which now everybody does. So you design around liability. How do you design around unintended acceleration? You make damn sure they have to have their foot on the brake before they can ever put it in drive. And we still have unintended acceleration problems.
My thing on this Toyota thing also was this personal responsibility. It reminds me of the lawsuit 5 years ago in Texas for the woman who or person who went through the McDonald's drive-thru and burnt their tongue on coffee. Hey, when you buy coffee, it's usually a little hotter at first. I mean, where does this stop?
Right.
I mean, that was my point, and apparently,
Americans are used to some kind of insurance policy.
Well, no, they're used
to blame. And if one doesn't exist,
we've become a no accountability, you know, blame somebody, sue me, sue you society, and I'll tell you, it's not a good look in anything, cars, anything.
No, I'm totally with you, and I think Toyota's being unfairly singled out in this floor mat thing because of this horrific accident where these four people were killed. And, you know, I know there's personal responsibility, but I'm sorry that that happened with them. But Toyota's going to be, you know, branded as the dangerous floor mat company. Oh, come on. I mean, floor mats are floor mats, right? I mean, they're in that big of a difference. When Ford had the Pinto fire things, guess what? Every other small car of the late 70s era had the exact same problem. Hit them enough in the back and kaboom, they go up in flames. Mm-hmm. Audi was not the only one having unintended acceleration problems. But because there was a slightly higher preponderance because of all these old Buick and Oldsmobile buyers who were hitting the wrong pedal, they got branded as the ones who had unintended acceleration. I guarantee you right now today, NHTSA gets several reports a year of runaway acceleration. And they don't do anything about it because even they have learned it's a driver problem, not a car problem.
Well, we've even seen it locally around town. You'll hear about some... usually it's an elderly person that, you know, unintendedly hits
the
accelerator. It drives in through the paint plate glass window, you know.
Or what do you think of this theory that, you know, if a recall can help a company's brand if they handle it well at the dealership level? I think that's a bunch of BS.
Well, that is a bunch of BS because you don't want to do it. I mean Toyota's been on a negative roll here.
They have.
Sitting in a debate with another journalist who shall remain nameless about it, about this, and I said, oh, I get it. So, because the person wrote something saying that this would help, you know, this could help.
There is a way, and I'll tell you a good example.
But what I said is, Lutz has it all wrong. 60-day guarantees, and you know. May the best car. He just needs to recall a bunch of cars, and that'll fix it.
But here's how Saturn did have the best recall ever, and I blogged about this on Autoblog today. Back early in the second year of the Saturn run, there was a supplier who sent them the wrong antifreeze to go in the radiator.
Right.
And I think it was from Texaco. And what they sent them was essentially like Drano. It was like pouring Drano into the engine. And in short order, it just destroyed the thing. And what Saturn did at the time was not tell customers, oh, if you have this problem, come in and we'll rebuild the engine for free. They did not say we will replace the engine for free. They said, come on back. Pick out a brand new car. Take whatever you want. And I had a friend who had a Saturn at the time, an LS2, and he went, damn, I wish my car was recalled. And that's when I was like, oh, my God, that's how you do a recall. You make people wish that their car had been recalled.
Well, the point I was making about recalls, you know, can they help your brand? You may make happy the person who already has your car. But for the people who might be shopping you who don't yet have a Toyota or whatever brand is recalling it, it's just bad news. I mean, Toyota's given us that line for a long time that, well, we handle it well and it can actually help a brand. No, it mitigates the damage, but it doesn't help you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, enough of us talking. Let's get to what our viewers want to hear us talk about and get to their questions. It's time for rapid fire. Ben, bring it up.
I was getting ready to get under
Ben
the
table. Ben told me that is actually Jason Vines.
I know.
I was expecting Ben to Google search for that. Remember that old song, Branded?
Oh, yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
When we were talking about being branded for bad things.
Okay, Scotty in Cleveland wants to know, do you think there's any room in Toyota's lineup to bring back the Celica? What do you think, Eric? Would you bring back the Celica? Or great. Celica, as our friends in Canada say?
No, I don't know that there's a lot of room. Right now, part of Toyota's problem is they are now becoming a large automaker.
And well, they're like GM, too many models.
They have a lot of models, and they are really starting to parse up their models. There's very little white space, as I would say, for Toyota right now. So I think they probably need to focus on other things, making the Camry maybe stylistically better to compete better in that large midsize sedan segment.
No to the Celica, but I would bring back the Super Twin Turbo, the last one they sold in the late 90s here, which was a really cool car.
That was wickedly fast. Yes, that was a cool car. Hey, we've got a phone comment. We had asked people to say, you know, some of their thoughts about Saturn. And, Ben, let's bring in the one that we got from Harry Douglas.
John, Harry Douglas here, Car Concerns. I'm answering your tweet here. Saturn, memories of Saturn. My memories of Saturn are great when it first started out, General Motors. It was going to be a revolutionary new thing, and it really caused some excitement. They used to bring all the Saturn buyers down to Spring Hill, Tennessee, once a year for a Saturn get-together, but General Motors got away from it. And soon, Saturn became just another General Motors automobile. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. It got ate up by the General Motors line. So, the Saturn vehicles duplicated the other General Motors lines in GMC and Chevrolet. And what's the use? What was the use? So I'm sorry to see that the Penske deal didn't work out. I didn't think that it would in the long run. It got Penske some very good PR, but Saturn will be gone.
Well, that's a good good point.
What's your question again?
Yeah. No, that was just a comment, right?
I know, just teasing.
But, you know, they kind of walked away from their customer base.
Well, I think Saturn started out with a great product. I mean, it was an excellent value, very competitive with anything coming out of Honda or Toyota.
It was a very mundane automobile, make no mistake, but
right.
Hal Reiney created.
Styling was fresher than.
Yeah, the SL2, especially the wagon, looked pretty good.
Well, Hal Reiney created an aura, literally, around this thing that the car really wasn't that great. I mean, the motor was like the Briggs and Stratton. I mean, actually, Briggs and Stratton was better sounding. But
I remember the initial Saturn, though, Peter, and you got inside of it, and it really felt the interior just felt a little more expensive, I guess.
Well, you know what? It was the most powerful piece of auto advertising.
Yes.
One of the most brilliant,
I think,
ever.
The death knell for Saturn was really rung in 98 or 99 because they went most of the 90s with nothing for those Saturn S series buyers to graduate to. And then when they finally did, they came out with the L series, which is a bad car.
Oh, yeah. But the S series.
It was a loser. And anyone who was going to graduate looked at it and said, and I think they were all gone. I think a lot of the buyers
got gone. Progressively worse. I mean, every redesign of the S series got worse.
Well, that's. Oh, and then the Ion.
Yeah. And then they tried to ultimately reposition Saturn, take it more up market, and make it more of a true competitor with Volkswagen. The problem was is their customer wasn't going to follow them there because they were used to, after incentives and rebates, $13,000 for an Ion or maybe $19,000 for a View, but you put a $30,000 plus Outlook in the showroom and it's just...
They never got away from entry level, and then by the time they did over the last couple of years with the product... It was too late. The people were gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, Saturn was the perfect example of GM's too many divisions thing because Oldsmobile and Chevrolet were just screaming, why are you giving Saturn all this money? Mm-hmm. You know, when Saturn people need other vehicles, we'll sell them Oldsmobiles. Remember John Rock said that? And so Saturn never got the product they needed at the crucial time. And from then on, it was a downward
spiral. Roger was the patron saint of Saturn. And once he was gone, that's when the, a lot of the infighting again kind of heated up, right, for product and marketing money?
Well, Roger Smith's vision for Saturn was a whole other country, a whole manufacturing process. The actual reality Saturn was just a different retail premise,
right?
Which
really
changed the industry.
Good marketing. Yeah.
Changed and brilliant
good
marketing.
Yes.
Well, we'll come back to this, but speaking about too many brands, Mud Monster 37 wants to know, what do you think about the Ram becoming its own brand?
I got to tell you, I think they need to shut off the espresso machines out in Auburn Hills immediately. Do they really need another brand? Not only that, but we have found out through our various advertising channels that they're going to have four different agencies, ad agencies, working on. They just don't have that much going on. I mean, get one good agency and they can sort out the four. But they've got four different agencies. They've added a brand, Dodge.
What's wrong with competition? Make the agencies compete for ideas, maybe? Is that what they're trying to do? I don't know.
Well, they've had like 10 agencies.
When you go to Chrysler and what they're doing, I don't understand any of the. I mean, Ram being its own brand, I don't understand it. It's always been known
as Dodge. Unless it means they're just going to get rid of Dodge.
Unless, exactly. Or maybe maybe there could be a potential suitor. Someone may have an interest in the Dodge Ram.
Oh, but geez, if Chrysler doesn't have the Ram, you know, where are they going to make money?
I mean, well, that's just it. So, I mean, you really have to start to wonder what are the long-term prospects for Chrysler overall. But then the other thing is they want to, I don't know if you had heard this, but they want to take Chrysler more up market. And I heard reports.
I've heard this one before. They tried to do that too.
Daimler tried to do that. They took the Pacifica, and remember, they took that as tried to make Chrysler go more up market. Right. Then it didn't sell. They decontented and brought the base down to, what, 23,000?
Daimler tried to take Chrysler up market. Didn't work. Mm-hmm. Volkswagen has tried to go up market with more expensive cars. You got to earn your way up there. You cannot just go into the market and by decree say that you are premium or luxury or up market.
No. It better be a 20 to 25-year plan, and you better have deep enough pockets to go that long.
I always said I've said that so many times, John, you need time and money. And I know GM didn't have
this
it.
This business doesn't have either.
Upmarket.
Chrysler never, they don't have either one of those things right now.
Okay, Volt 230 wants to know, no more V6s in a Sonata? Good or bad idea? I don't know if you guys heard the next generation Sonata we were talking about will only come with a four-cylinder engine.
I think consumers better get used to this movement in the engines. I think you're going to see four-cylinder boosted engines instead of V6s in a lot more products. So it's whether it's good or bad, that's the reality of what's happening going forward.
I would agree. I think we're going to see a lot more mid-size cars going forward because of CAFE regulations.
Yeah, and no question.
Hyundai's got one of the best CAFE numbers out there. I think they might have the best next to Suzuki.
Yeah.
I mean, for a broader line.
But their focus is on smaller vehicles. They don't have
Suzuki's, as you mean.
And Hyundai, too, for that matter.
Why would you get, well, I guess it may make better economic sense. I mean, I was thinking maybe you offer the V6 but put a big enough premium on it, but then you don't get the volume to justify.
I think GM is going to rush that four-cylinder for the LaCrosse.
Mm. I think, you know, back with the Hyundai, I think, you know, when you look at their mix, it's 85%, maybe a little over 85% that are actually four cylinders currently with
the
Sonata.
You know, the Camry's pretty high four-cylinder mix, too.
Is
it like 60? Is it really that high?
I think.
Wow.
Yes.
I was going to say 65 or 70 for four cylinder. I know it's high.
85% is what they said is
for four cylinder.
No, not Camry.
Camry's really high four cylinder content.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Well, look at the price. They charge at least on the premium model, they charge $2,000 to get the V6. It's even more on the lesser contented ones to get it. So they made a lot of money on those V6s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's more eye-opening to me is that they're walking away from the profit potential that offers.
Now, the interesting thing is that I'll be interested to see how the 2.4, the larger four-cylinder for the Sonata, and how does it perform? We talk about boosted four-cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
Will there be anything? If
it's tractor-like, they'll be in trouble. If it's good, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, the Genesis Coupe, the 2-liter turbo, very buzzy engine. Very buzzy.
Toyota may have better economies of scale because they sell V6s in a lot of different vehicles. If Hyundai charged a premium for the V6, the volume may be so low that it doesn't make economic sense for them to do it.
Very possibly, but
I don't know.
FA's got more reason to make the decision than anything else.
I agree.
Okay, let's see. Oh, here's a great comment. We got it from a guy named Asian Martin. This is just a comment. He put together some good puns using the names of Saturn cars. Sky is falling. Deal must have had a bad aura. The outlook is grim. There is no positive view. Kiss their Astra goodbye.
I have to say, that's pretty creative.
That's pretty clever.
Very creative.
I think it is. Let's see. What do we have here?
And a
Ronald Wright wrote in to say, so is it RIP Saturn or is it, hey, Magna, look what I found. Is somebody else going to come in and pick up Saturn?
You know, GM said they were going to shut it down.
Yeah, they're building till the end of this year, and then they're shutting the plants down, and they're retailing what's left throughout 2010.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose if Fritz Henderson got a call from someone, you know, tomorrow morning offering him.
Well, I'll expect my check from Hyundai in the mail tomorrow for my idea for Equus taking over. If I were Hyundai, I'd get all the same. Like I said, get them all in a showroom and a ballroom in Las Vegas and lay it out and say, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
I bet you 100% of them would say, sure.
What's the brand name going to be?
Equus.
Mm-hmm. Here's one for Eric from John Wills. He says, I'm going to paraphrase this real fast. He says, been a lot of talk from the Fed about the recession being over, but I see very little evidence. Do you think most economists are missing the big picture in regards to the housing crisis? Do you believe 2010 and 2011 will reset mortgage resets will affect our economy? He's asking a bunch of questions here, but basically, I guess it is, are we out of this recession? And yeah, where is all the evidence we're out of the recession?
No, I think that we're out of the recession now. It doesn't quite feel that way, and it never really does as you come out of a recession because the labor markets always lag, so that's why it doesn't really feel that way. But much of the data, if you look at the PMI, Purchasing Managers Index, it would indicate that we're coming out. You look at the Economic Cycle Research Institute index of leading economic indicators, that's really off the charts now to the upside. Of course, it was off the charts to the downside if you look back in the fourth quarter of last year. So a lot of the leading economic indicators are pretty positive. We are seeing some sequential recovery in housing, and I think that we're going to get there. I think that we could see a more robust rebound than a lot of people are thinking. But keep in mind, though, most of the people judge the economy, we're not, that doesn't mean we're going to get back to 2006 or 2007 levels of economic output. All it means is that we're going to best second quarter of this year because it's an annualized growth rate.
Yeah, it just means that there's some growth, right.
And it's just been so depressed in the fourth quarter of last year, the first quarter of this year. Even the second quarter, we still saw a contraction. And, so I think anytime I've seen a contraction and went back and studied recessions all the way back to post-World War II, anytime I've seen a contraction of anything greater than 4% to the downside for an extent, and I think everyone would recognize that this is a really nasty recession. In fact, I had to go back to some cases the 40s and the 50s to find things that would compare. But anytime we've had that kind of contraction to the downside, it's always produced a pretty significant upside rebound just because you're comparing to such a low base and such a major contraction.
Look, this is one of those instances where the economist's definition of what the recession is and when we emerge from it is vastly different from what people feel because
yes.
Their home equity is still, you know, their home equity is still way down, or they're upside down in their house, they're upside down in their car.
401k.
Yeah, 401k's evaporated, and they still can't find a good job or any job, or they're worried about losing their job, or their benefits have been cut. And it's a long time before all of that stuff that the average man on the street doesn't care about economic growth numbers that you read in Section C of the Wall Street Journal.
Are there jobs available?
Yeah. How do I feel? Can I take a vacation this year? Am I going to have a job next year?
Do I feel confident in the job that I have, or if I'm out of work, do I feel confident in finding a job? That's really the man on the street. I mean, that's how the man on the street feels. And what we really need to focus on and look at, and it's going to be tomorrow, which is kind of the Super Bowl for most economists, it's the job numbers. And while I'm not expecting positive numbers, I think they'll still be negative. I think that the rate of that decline will begin to decelerate. So I'm looking for about 180,000.
There was a survey of HR saying that they were starting to cease the cuts in benefits and jobs. A lot of them are saying that.
Yeah. So
say that number again. You're looking for what tomorrow?
About 170,000 to 180,000 jobs. A contraction or a loss of 170,000 to 180,000 jobs, and that will be for the month of September.
Okay.
So that
would be a significant improvement.
A significant improvement. People have to understand that in the first quarter of this year alone, we lost about 2.05, 2.06 million jobs in the first quarter, almost 700,000 jobs a month. So clearly that was one of the most significant contractions that I've been able to find. Unless you go back to 1957, that was another time when the contraction was very significant. But that's certainly the jobs are going to be paramount to our economy going forward.
Hey, let's get to this quick. We got another phoner. Ben, let's bring in that comment from Jeff Taylor on Saturn.
Hi, John View. This is Jeff Taylor calling with respect to the good, bad memories of Saturn. I had a 94 SL2, and I really liked it a lot. I cross-shopped it against the Corolla, and the Corollas weren't available at the time with anti-lock brakes, so that's what swayed me towards the Saturn. I really liked the car. It was a lot of fun. I went to the Saturn homecoming and really enjoyed that as well. unfortunately, after that, they never really made any products I liked until real recently, and I was hoping for an Astro Red line, but obviously that's never going to happen. So anyway, great show. Thanks. Bye.
Jeff, take two martinis and call us in the morning.
But gets back to your point of the early Saturns were actually quite well contented. You know, his point.
ABS.
ABS. And what did they call it? ABS-6, right? That was a very clever low-cost system that Delphi had developed that GM started to put across the board and Saturn put it across the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for one shining moment in time, GM nailed it. Mm-hmm. Marketing, product,
it all
content,
together. All converged.
Retail, dealers, everything.
Mm-hmm. And they stopped.
It was gone in 24 months. Or 36 months.
Okay, we got quite a few questions here to get to, but maybe we got one time for one more. What looks good here? Will GM still be doing a performance division like the Cadillac V-Series? And will Buick ever get its own performance division?
No, Buick won't get a performance division, but don't worry, GM will still do performance cars. As long as they're alive and kicking, there'll be some performance. Mm-hmm. With Mark Royce there, who...
Well, they have them right now. They have a Camaro SS. They've got Cadillac V cars.
Camaro Z28's coming. Mark Royce is back. They'll be in that game.
Yeah, and the V is
sensational.
It's just sensational, and that will continue on, but...
The CTS-V Coupe, oh, man.
Oh, I know. that's one to drool over.
You know, I've heard they've moved the CTS up, Coupe up, from next August to, like, 3 months earlier.
Yes.
I think a CTS-V wagon would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't think that's in the plans, but I like the CTS wagon. I think it's a really well-styled wagon.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
I don't know if it's in the plan either. I just think it'd be a cool car. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not a wagon guy, but, man, it looks awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, look, we ought to wrap it up. We're at the top of the hour here. I want to thank all you guys, and we have to thank everybody who is watching. Also, remember, you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/AutoLineDetroit, Twitter, twitter.com/AutoLine, AutoExtremist, twitter.com/AutoExtremist. You can find David Welch at businessweek.com.
Sure. Look for the AutoBeat blog.
And,
as well as my stories on the website.
As well as those. And you can find Eric Merkel at twitter.com/@autoeconomy.
Yes, and also autoeconomy.com.
Well, great having you here, Eric. It's been great. Good
Thank
insight
you.
As to what's
Thank
going on
you.
In
Thank
this
you very
business.
Much. Pleasure. Always enjoy it.
Visit our website, AutoLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutoLineDetroit.tv.